Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
And I'm Lucy Pony, also in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, December 17th, 2014. Despite a year of violence and what some call war crimes in South Sudan, there have been few public protests. Why?
Even me, I come here through difficulties. I spent about 5 days in the bush without drinking any water. I taste also even the urine. I drink the urine.
And another media raid occurs in Juba.
The explanation was after the editor-in-chief went to National Security Headquarters in Jebel, they told him that we had published, we had used photos of the rebels.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus.
There is a lot to be angry about in South Sudan, especially among the young, far better educated generation who feels alienated by the leaders who have waged a war for power at the expense of people just 2 years after independence. But to date, there has been little public protest. Analysts say the tens of thousands of refugees and jobless have no time for taking to the streets. Their main concern is to make ends meet. Benno Muchler reports from Juba on why there is a lack of protests.
Michael Dengadwell is a refugee. He is one of about 50,000 who have sought safe haven from the fighting at a United Nations site near Bentiu, a strategic town near some of South Sudan's most important oil fields. It has changed hands many times during the year-old conflict. On a recent morning, the 26-year-old primary school teacher recounted his difficult experience.
Even me, I come here through difficulties. I spent about 5 days in the bush without drinking any water. I taste also even the urine. I drink the urine.
Deng has a lot to be angry about. He came here almost exactly 1 year ago, just about when war broke out. Since then, he says he has led a life that seems no better than that of an animal. Flies swarmed around his head while he talks sitting in a heated mud hut covered with plastic sheets. The UN camp stands on a barren field with no escape from the South Sudanese sun. Food, water, and electricity are scarce. But the worst part, people say, is having nothing to do and feeling imprisoned because outside the camp it's too dangerous. Asked why no one protests against their elected leaders who are responsible for this situation, Deng had this to say.
The problem is that Africa in general, is different from Europe, is different from USA, is different from other continents. In South Sudan here, we say that South Sudan, we use democratic system. And that one, it remains in the box. If you make a protest now, you can be killed.
Soldiers and guns are omnipresent. The government is mostly made up of former guerrillas, with no room for outsiders who did not physically fight for independence that became reality 3 years ago. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement Party rules the country with an iron fist. In the history of many countries, it was often a student movement that began a struggle for change. But following ethnic clashes between students at Juba University 2 years ago, the school administration banned student associations. Outside the university, medical student David Tut Ali said they fear to openly speak their minds.
And it's very difficult to express our feelings. They just talk of freedom, of which freedom is not in place, it is not in action.
Many students shared his opinion but feared sharing their names because of South Sudan's security service. After three more student interviews, a man in plain clothes approached, insisted in Arabic to follow him to a police station, and took my journalistic accreditation. I asked a nearby soldier to be my translator and follow me as a backup. After a 5-minute walk, the plainclothes officer relented and then told me to report to him the next day. Deng Atuay Mawir, one of South Sudan's most outspoken government critics, knows all too well the risks for activists. As the head of the South Sudan Civil Society Alliance, he has challenged the government of President Salva Kiir and his former deputy-turned-rebel Riek Machar many times. 2 years ago, he was kidnapped. And just a few weeks ago, he says, an unknown gunman almost killed him on the street.
I start the car. Somebody came out on the other right, on the side, and he shot. I heard the bullet tell. He broken the both windows, and he missed me here. And then from there, I just came out. The second shooting shot me from here.
Today, Deng Atwaima Weir lives in a secured hotel of a friend that he seldom leaves. But he doesn't want to go in exile. He said South Sudan is his country, and he wants to correct the difficult situation that his people are in. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Juba.
South Sudan security officers are being blamed for confiscating copies of the Nation Mirror newspaper and English Daily. This follows the paper's publication of various photos and articles on the rebels' battles with government forces over the past year. Wake Simon Wudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
Beka Lule, the editor of the Nation Mirror newspaper, told the VOA in an exclusive interview that government security officers confiscated about 2,500 copies of Tuesday's edition. Media owners and analysts say this raid is the latest assault on media freedom of expression in war-torn South Sudan. Lule describes what happened.
Yesterday, I received a call from the people who distribute the paper that we normally distribute it at the Citizen newspaper and also somewhere in Juba town. He received a call from security asking where he was. So they directed them where they were. And they told them, we need these papers. So they took the papers.
Lule says the security officers told him the paper has violated the government's directives on how the paper should publish information regarding the ongoing conflict.
The explanation was after the editor-in-chief went to National Security Headquarters in Jebel, they told him that we had published, we had used photos of the rebels.
Lule says his paper published a front-page story highlighting the plans of rebel leader Riek Machar to appoint one of his commanders, Simon Gatwich, as his rebel chief of staff. Earlier reports indicated Peter Gadet would assume that position. Lule says publishing a photo of Machar and Gadet in the front-page article led to the confiscation. Lule denies the article was promoting the rebels' position as claimed by the security agents. As of today, the paper has not printed its Wednesday edition. Lule explains his company is still negotiating with the security officials. He says his company, the Nation Mirror, typically prints at least 3,000 copies of the daily paper in Juba. Copies of the same paper are distributed to the other parts of the country as well. He says he was not completely surprised by the confiscation since security officers previously called his management for explanation on a number of other stories published by the paper. But he says this marks the first time copies of the Nation Mirror have been confiscated since it began its operation 7 months ago.
Being out of the market is really a challenge. First of all, there are costs you have to meet, That paper was already printed, we had already paid for it. So whether you continue publishing, you have already made a loss. You have paid people, you have done everything. But again, it is also a challenge on those people who cover the news.
The raid follows similar incidents involving other newspapers in the country, including the Juba Monitor and Citizen in recent months. South Sudan's parliament passed the 3 media laws that were recently signed into law by the president. Oliver Modi, chairman of the Union of Journalists of South Sudan, calls this most recent confiscation an irresponsible act.
If there is any problem, let the security sector consult the management, the administration of the media house, and let them address the issue. What is it all about? Not jumping into conclusion by confiscating a newspaper or maybe stopping the newspaper not to continue is a total damage to the newspaper.
After the outbreak of violence a year ago, the government issued an order restricting media coverage of reports on rebel forces. Despite the new media laws, the order from the Minister of Information and Broadcasting, Michael Makueleth, essentially labeled any journalist reporting on rebel activity as being affiliated with the rebels themselves. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu from Juba.
The year-old conflict has not only devastated many towns and villages across South Sudan, it has also devastated the nation's economy. Analysts say the conflict has tarnished South Sudan's image worldwide. As a result, some foreign investors are reluctant to help develop the country. We have several stories on South Sudan's economic future for you, beginning with Charlton Doki in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
South Sudan relies on oil for more than 95% of its revenues. At the height of the fighting, oil production was shut down in Unity State, the country's second oil-producing state. Petroleum Ministry officials say South Sudan's oil production stands at 160,000 barrels per day. That's down from 245,000 barrels per day before the crisis began. James Alich Garang, an economist at the Juba-based Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says the decline in oil production translates into far less currency circulating in South Sudan, which hurts everybody.
Because the oil production has been cut short at Unity, the oil revenue that came into the government purse declined. And as a result, the liquidity of the government is limited, and therefore the central bank does not have enough liquidity to fight this crunching appreciation of the dollars or the appreciation of the fund. And this appreciation of the dollars has a negative impact on the economy. Of course, our importers are finding it very hard now to import goods from abroad.
Zakaria Ding Akol, a policy analyst at the Juba-based SAD Institute, says the violence also hampered government efforts to refine South Sudanese oil for local consumption.
Before the crisis, the government managed to build a refinery, a mini refinery in Unity State. That has been affected, but it cost millions to build it. So it is sitting there, but it's not giving us what we wanted. So if it was operational, it was going to give the country an ability to get refined product, some of which could have be sufficient for local consumption, and maybe if there was surplus, it could be sold in the region, which was going to generate more money that would have helped the economy.
And Ding says, due to the shortage of hard currency caused by the conflict, commercial banks are also feeling the pinch.
I've been told that the banks have not been getting the allocations that they used to get for quite some time now. It is the forex that are still getting, but the commercial banks are not getting. And also because of the crisis, the whole Greater Upper Nile region has been affected. And so there is some allocation in terms of currency that goes now to those three states, which is why the central bank find it difficult to give anything to commercial banks.
The conflict broke out just 1 week after South Sudan held an investment conference, which government hoped would have led to an increase in direct foreign investment. Although there are no statistics to indicate the exact financial losses caused by the conflict, Garang says there is no doubt investor confidence in South Sudan has been shaken. Investors who were about to come to South Sudan are now holding off. And Garang says the conflict has led to a general decline in economic activity, especially in the hard-hit states of Unity, Jonglei, and Upper Nile.
Let's take, for example, a county in Unity State, where the war was really hard fought there. Those farmers, those individual households, could not do the planting when the time was right.
And because of insecurity, commodity prices skyrocketed.
The people who are doing business in this kind of environment are taking risk. And to take risk, you have to have a reason why you are doing it. And so you have to add something that more than normal in order for you to justify why you are doing it.
But opposition politician, head of the SPLMDC, Lam Akol Ajawin, argues there was no development in South Sudan to begin with.
We had a government that didn't concern itself with the interests of the people, and they got involved in corruption, in doing things that have nothing to do with the development. So there has never been any development.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Kampala, Uganda.
But there is a bit of good news on the economic front. The Egyptian government says it has finalized plans to construct a multi-billion dollar dam in South Sudan that will help South Sudan improve its power capacity and also provide water for irrigation in Wau. The Egyptian delegation is in Juba following President Kiir's visit to Egypt last month. From Juba, Mugume Davis Wakarinji files this report.
The announcement was made by Hossam Al-Maghazi, Egyptian Minister for Water and Irrigation, in a news conference in Juba last night. Al-Maghazi says this is part of bilateral support given South Sudan to improve its infrastructure. He says the dam will cost around $3 to $4 billion, which will be funded by Egypt and other donors. Once completed, the dam
can store about 2 billion cubic meters for generation electricity and store water for agriculture, and then I can give a message that Egypt don't stop building dams if it is not harm the downstream country.
Al-Maghazi says plans are underway to mobilize resources and start construction by February next year. Ayman El-Gamal, the Egyptian ambassador in South Sudan, says the project is part of his country's policy to help develop the Nile Basin countries.
When you increase the level of development of a country, investment and trade opportunities increase. Currently, South Sudan does not have that capacity because the problem of infrastructure in South Sudan.
Nile Basin countries are the 10 nations connected by the River Nile. Besides Egypt and South Sudan, other members are Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Sudan, Tanzania and Uganda. Last month, Egypt signed agreements worth $26.6 million to provide assistance to South Sudan. Al-Maghazi says he was impressed to see that some of the projects have already begun, including one that provides clean water to Juba residents.
Today, when I visit the first well, which is already finished, and the people come to drink water, they are very happy. When you see the people, their eyes and their face are laughing, and very everyone wanted to sing and or to shake hand. So I feel that is just a small thing. We want to add more, because the water is, you know, it is the life.
Dr. Lul Riek, the Minister of Health's International Health Coordinator, says such a contributions can have a tremendous impact on the nation.
It is very important that our people that can have access to safe and clean water. It will reduce the mortality rate, especially among the children under the age of 5 that are dying from diarrhea. It can reduce it almost to half, because children, they die because of malaria. The second cause of death is the diarrhea in this country. And the diarrhea, they get it because of the lack of the access to the safe and clean water.
Riek says less than half of South Sudan's population has access to clean water. Egypt has pledged to also donate much-needed health equipment and train health workers across South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
The government says it will launch a reconstruction project on one of the country's busiest transportation networks, the Juba-Yeikaya Road. Officials believe this road, which connects the country to East Africa via Uganda, will greatly improve South Sudan's economic prospects. For VOA News, Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
South Sudan Minister of Transport, Roads and Bridges Kwang Danher Gatluak says the road project will cost about $514 million.
Studies after studies have been carried out for the last 5 years, and we were planning as a ministry and as a government looking for funding and the opportunity when it would be the right time to build that road. And we are in advanced stage with the Minister of Finance trying to negotiate and to see the terms of the loan agreement. And as soon as the Minister of Finance is through with the loan agreement, we'll commence the work.
The Juba-Yeikaya Road starts in the capital and passes through Lanya and Yei, ending in Morobo County at Kaya at the border with Uganda. Before the completion of the current lifeline Juba-Nimule Highway, the road was the main thoroughfare connecting South Sudan's capital Juba to East Africa. The road has an important historical significance. During the decades of civil war fought between Juba and Khartoum, millions of South Sudanese fled to Uganda via the Juba-Yei-Kaya road. Member of Parliament Thomas Wanikundu, who represents Lainya County, sets some light on the road's history.
The SPLA broke the backbone of Jalaba through the Yei road by a swift and then a heavy victory caused on Jalaba in 1997 from Kaya out to Bridge 40. It was through the Yei road. The second thing is the SPLA entered Juba in 2005 through Yei road.
Jalaba was a derogatory term used by then-South Sudanese fighters against the Khartoum regime to refer to their Arab enemies. Jimmy Wongo, Minister of Physical Infrastructure for Central Equatorial State, says reconstructing the road should improve life for many local residents as well as boost the agricultural sector.
The road is going to remove the challenges of transporting food from the neighboring countries. Areas like Lanya, Yei, and Kaya are very productive areas, and therefore the produce will find its way to the markets of Juba, and also transporting people and any other things this way.
Yei and Morobo are some of the leading agricultural food-producing counties in Central Equatorial State. Wongo says in the past, lack of stable roads has meant farmers had no way of transporting their fruits and vegetables to Juba markets. Gatluak says if Parliament approves the loan as expected, work on the road should begin early next year. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu from Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a look back at the year of conflict. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
is it important to be polite to everyone, including those you do not like?
Yeah, it is important to be polite to everyone, including those you do not like, because two wrongs never make a right. So to me, it's important to be polite to everyone, including those who don't like you.
Actually, if you are polite, you must teach or to advise others so that they can be so polite and to get the goodness of the politeness of what you are talking about.
It is important to be polite because being polite alone, it means a lot. It makes you like to fit in any environment you are in. Even if you don't like somebody and you're trying to be polite to that person, you're hiding yourself.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA. You're still listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Suzanne Page was the top U.S. diplomat in South Sudan 1 year ago. Ambassador Page was in Juba when the political violence broke out. After consulting with top officials in Washington, she decided to stay in Juba despite the violence. In the third and final part of her interview with South Sudan in Focus host John Tanza, she describes that decision.
We had gone forward many times saying that any attempt to remove an elected government would have real ramifications for us, for the Americans, because of our law, and that we would have to invoke that and we would have to cease our support, except for humanitarian assistance, in the event of a successful coup, let's put it that way. The tale also that was being told that seems to have been forgotten was that there were rumors that the former vice president had taken refuge in the U.S. embassy. There were also rumors that he had taken refuge in the British embassy. There were also rumors that he had taken refuge in the at the home or at the office of the United Nations special representative of the Secretary General, none of which turned out to be true. And obviously, I knew who was at my own embassy and our residential compound, and I repeatedly said that. But even today, people still have that belief that the former vice president and or others took refuge, again, whether it was at the U.S. embassy or elsewhere. I'm only responsible for my, you know, what I know, but I know that that was not the case and that that the former vice president had fled the country or had fled the city. So there were a lot of rumors, a lot of disinformation going on. And what we did not have was any evidence of a coup attempt at that moment. And as soon as we knew, and former Vice President Riek Machar was quite outspoken about exactly what his aims were, well, of course, we called it what it was.
A lot of military experts in the area were saying what happened in Juba is very far from a coup attempt. There were no signs of coup. Is that what you think?
I think the situation was so fluid at the time, and people were looking for definitive answers on December 16th. What we know is that the government was falling apart and that the Ugandans had come in to help shore up the government of South Sudan, which they have a right to do, but that there were a lot of displaced people and a lot of people taking shelter who felt unsafe about the situation inside Juba because of the killings that had occurred in the early days in Juba in particular. So it was important for us to help also to try to spread the word of peace and reconciliation. Lots and lots of people have lost their lives. And so what we've been trying our best to do is really to call for accountability.
And if you're given a chance to speak your heart once more to the people of South Sudan, I know that when you were leaving, you had, you know, you didn't have enough time to greet everybody and speak to everybody. But if you are given a chance to speak out your heart today to the people of South Sudan, both your friends in the government, in the opposition, what would you tell them?
I would tell them to have a vision for the country that they can live up to what the people of South Sudan asked for them to do, for their leaders to be accountable to the population, to the people of South Sudan, to think about future generations, to have the courage to make decisions that may not benefit them directly, but that will benefit the nation and especially the future generations. And that's about leadership, courage, and vision. It's difficult to do, but difficult decisions are entrusted to people who can make them. And that's what I would call on those who are fighting, whether they're in the opposition or in the government, and those who are maybe on the sidelines, is to remember this is the season of Advent. The South Sudanese are a very proud people, but they're a very spiritual people. It's the season of the Prince of Peace when he's coming. And to use this season of Advent to really once and for all bring that peace, the peace of God that surpasses all understanding, and be able to reconcile with their neighbor. You can't forget the past. It doesn't go away. But you can forgive by being able to have some sort of understanding about what happened and be able to move forward and not hold that against the entire nation for what maybe an individual has done or even a collection of individuals, but to think about the best interests of the country.
Susan Page is the former U.S. ambassador to South Sudan. She was speaking to South Sudan in Focus host John Tanza last week at the State Department here in Washington. Ambassador Page is currently a senior advisor in the office of the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan. The office of the U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan provides the funding for South Sudan in Focus.
And that's our show for this Wednesday.
I'm Lucy Pony in Washington.
And I'm Nabil Biagio, also in Washington. Thanks for listening. We now leave you with the song Love Your Neighbor by Benjamin Lexin.
Saki, mata ang isujira, dati kang meskin.